All right. I'm finally back on Escape from Plan A. I've been traveling a little bit, so apologies for the delayed episode. And also, just a couple housekeeping things. We changed hosting platforms, so you may see disruption. I know we like disappeared off Spotify, so I'll go and fix that. But if you notice anything strange about like your availability of episodes, that's the reason. But everything should be working now. So any issues, you can contact us at the patreon.com/plantymag. We'll have a contact there. But so far, I think we're okay. But anyways, we're back to our normally scheduled releases. And I've got a friend from Twitter, Fred Soda. How's it going?
It's going great. How are you?
It's good, man. It's good that we're finally talking because I really enjoy some of the pylons we get into on Twitter with some of our, it's kind of like a little circle of accounts that I don't really know any of them in person, but it's quite a bit of fun. Cause I think there's a lot being said about economics and, you know, social commentary and all that stuff. And it's just it's an interesting time.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I just have to say, you know, I'm really glad that I found you. And, you know, this small group of accounts you're referring to, because, you know, it's like a lot of this stuff you can talk about in real life, but there's no guarantee that people are going to understand what you're saying. And I feel like we in this group, we just have that general same sentiment. So it's good.
Yeah. And because you gave out a few details about yourself that I thought were really interesting. One is that you were, I think when I first met you on X, you were a student at Harvard Business School. And I was thinking, like, what is a Harvard MBA guy doing online with us? Like, we're fucking retards. Like, why? Don't you have like career development shit and networking to do, or, you know, something like that? But then I realized, like, it's a new era. It's a different generation. You're much younger than me. You're like, what, 30 or something in that ballpark, right? So I thought it would be interesting just because like we're like an Asian American podcast, which means that a lot of our audience is like very interested in career stuff, because that seems to be like a thing that I think a lot of like younger Asian American people are like really worried about.
Mm-hmm.
And you are right there. You're at an elite sort of grad school, pre-career, like a, you know, very, let's say like top tier careerist path in America. I just want to get, I wanted to talk to you because I wanted to get a sense of what that experience is like, what's going on in your head, and maybe even some of your peers, like what's the culture like now? I know that's very general, but
mm-hmm.
you know, what did you make of it? Cause it's a, you know, 2-year program. And
Yeah. Happy to start there. So, so I spent 2 years at Harvard Business School, or we'll refer to it as HBS for short, as it commonly goes by its acronym. It was a great program, general management degree. So you don't specialize in anything there. You can take subsets of classes that have like more of a core focus. So for me, I spent a lot of time just focused on, you know, startups, venture capital, and tech in general. That's where that's the industry I was like coming from, the space I was coming from prior to business school or pre-MBA. And then, you know, post-MBA, I'm working as a product manager at a bank. So yeah. So that's kind of like the high level professional journey within that, like, say, 2-year window.
Yeah.
My time there was great. I met a lot of interesting people. You know, a big critique of the MBA is that, like, well, you're paying a lot of money just to network. And I mean, like, yeah, that's true. But for me, it was interesting because I actually knew a lot of people going into it and had a lot of overlap with a great number of people in the tech, VC and entrepreneurship space. So there's that. But what I really gained from HBS, like net new, net positive, is a very like international way of thinking.
Okay.
40% of the class is, from abroad. And
Okay.
so what that gives you is just like a very different, perspective on business, on, networks, on just life in general. And that's the thing that I really have come to appreciate about HBS. I feel like I can have a lot more intelligible comments and sophisticated conversations because I've been exposed to such a global perspective, not only in the classroom, but out of the classroom as well. And some of these folks I've made are, some of my closest friends. So it was a wonderful time. I'm happy to chat more about it, but that's just kind of like a high level overview, I guess.
Yeah, what about, because I guess like, I'm thinking about it from the perspective of how the economic environment is deteriorating and we're hearing about pullback in hiring and tech, and there's sort of like a doom and gloom kind of feeling in the air, if not like quite yet like a recession or that kind of thing, but like it's not a super optimistic time. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
Was there an awareness of that, or was that just like in school and in the, I don't know if you did like OCI to get, like to get your job, and whether the, because you know how business school is, I guess it's a very forward looking, everyone's always very pumped and eager to hit the ground running. But then there's this background of like economic malaise. Or did that factor into like what, how people think about moving ahead in their career, or do you just kind of shut that noise out and just say, just keep moving forward?
It's a mix of both. So I'll start with my own case, and I'll branch out to my peers. And it's heavily dependent on like your economic background, right? Your socioeconomic background. So while I was in school, it was a pretty big issue that like the job market was tough, and good jobs, right? And I put good jobs in quotes because the median or the modal HBS student has a very specific idea of what a good job is for them, right?
You mean in
And
terms of comp?
yeah, not only in terms of comp, but prestige, as well as just kind of like the lifestyle it's going to afford them
Yeah.
and their partner if they're with someone, right? And so, yeah, I mean, like, it was pretty difficult to get like top tier positions that would be more routinely available. I mean, there are some people who still got them. I know one person who managed to land a technical PM role at OpenAI. It's probably like the highest caliber outcome I've seen so far.
Your
But other
class.
than that, I mean, it's just kind of like you have folks who, came from PE, heading back to PE, but they're not landing at a bigger mega fund. They're landing at, one or two tiers below, right? Investment banking got your usual crowd going into that. But if you're going into as an older person, it's tough. It's going to be a rough experience. It's, a lot of my classmates who came from that would say it's like a young man or young woman's game. And then there's consulting. The consulting was more normal, but the thing is that a lot of my friends who have taken on consulting, like they haven't even started their first engagements yet. Like they're still waiting to be staffed.
Right.
And so some of them are like
They're on the
taking on,
beach.
they're on the beach. Yeah, exactly. That's the lingo, right? So they're on the beach, they're taking on like part-time jobs in the meantime to make ends meet. Or, they're going on travels if, they come from a more well-heeled background, right? So, I mean, in my case, sorry, I kind of went broader as so we'll go broad to me now.
Yeah.
In my case, I kind of just jumped at, not the first thing, but like the first high quality offer I got. And so like I had a couple of job offers to consider, and was very fortunate to be in that position. And I picked one that that maximized comp versus work life balance. And I feel like I have a pretty like I've gotten like a pretty great outcome based on that. You know, in terms of prestige, like some people may agree, some people may disagree, right? I don't really care. That's not something I was optimizing for post MBA. But I do think like I've landed somewhere pretty nice. I'm happy where I'm at. It's a great culture, great work-life balance.
Wait, do you think you're unique in that sense, or do you think more of your classmates were thinking that way? Like,
I think I'm probably closer to, you know, so it's interesting. I think it's so this is a case of stated versus revealed preferences, right? You know, the stated preference would be like, no, I want like the plum job coming up out of HBS, like what an HBS grad should get, right? And then the revealed preference is like, look, I'll just take whatever's reasonable, right? Whatever's available. And so a lot more people are in that camp than in the former. And so
Even
that kind of
at HBS, I
even
mean,
at HBS, yeah,
yeah.
absolutely. So a really concise way to frame this would be like, you know, the HBS grad's problem is that they're not getting their first choice job. Like that's it, really. You know, most HBS grads, if like they absolutely had to take a job, they easily could get one, and that's that, right? But there's a significant portion who, you know, a combination of just like, you know, their background, their socioeconomic background, as well as like their particular taste, they either have the risk tolerance to wait or they have the financial cushion to wait. So there's that.
Right. Okay, so you're saying that for like the richer kids, there's a certain type of job that like a kid that needs to start earning couldn't really take. Like, what is that? Like an NGO type thing or a startup
So like
that,
one
you
thing
know,
that
pays you in equity and doesn't really give you much like cash comp, or what would that look like for some, I'm just curious, like
A very concrete example of that would be like, you know, starting your own company, right? So that's like one. A second one, this is kind of like very field specific, but I would say it's like venture capital. Like a lot of firms, at least the top tier firms, like recruit like much, much later. So yeah, you know, it's like if you can risk graduating without a job and waiting for a firm to reach out or open a, you know, post a job opening, that's
Oh, I
great.
see.
But yeah, and then there's like some very like I'd say PE a little bit, but they were in a more structured recruiting process that happened during like, you know, the
PE
school year.
sounds like the wrong field to get into right now, no? Am I wrong about that? But like all I hear is that like PE is having like a, you know, it's kind of a disaster. Like a, it's kind of like a, I mean, it's a little bit opaque industry, so maybe we don't fully know, but you know, I've heard it's not the good years for PE, no? Am I
Yeah,
wrong?
no. It's I mean, it's not like all doom and gloom. It's but I mean, it's just like any sort of alternative, like, you know, asset class like PE, VC, it's not great. And so yeah, like I was saying earlier, like, you know, I had a number of friends, a number of classmates come from like top tier firms, and then they aren't able to like place back into those firms again. They have to take like a job at like a second tier firm or whatever. So there's that. But you know, the converse of your question is like, okay, what's like the most lucrative opportunity? Let's like something that's super hot right now. And that'd be private credit. And so I don't know what private credit is in like great detail, but it's basically like instead of your business getting like a loan from like an investment bank for like a typical like LBO, you go to like, you know, some specialized third party that has, you know, is able to extend you a line of credit at arguably favorable terms in the investment bank, and you go from there.
Shadow banking, I think we use that
Oh
word.
yeah.
Yeah.
It's a form of shadow banking, absolutely. And it's like completely unregulated or just like way less regulations compared to traditional like bulge bracket banks.
Yeah. It's so weird. It's like you go to like business school or you go to law school or you go to, you know, whatever. I guess it's really those two, to be honest. Maybe some master's programs in of various there's unlimited numbers of master's programs now, but they you always end up coming out and basically working in some sort of financial field, like whether it's at a bank or a fintech or even tech companies and all that stuff. I feel like so much of the top talent ends up speaking financialized lingo. Like, you'll say LBO to me. I'm a lawyer. I know exactly what you're talking about. You know, like, it's that's what it is, isn't it? It's, I think it's just like you just get closer and closer to the money. And that's really the goal. I think it's like, and I'm starting to understand this because, like, the comp that people are looking for, where it's like, you know, they like they want to be comfortably in the like mid six figures or getting closer to like seven figures or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
How the hell are you going to do that as a person who, I mean, frankly, I'm not talking about you specifically. I'm talking about like as a class, right? Like us as a class. I mean, if it were just like me going hanging up a shingle, I can't make any money. You know, I've got to be attached to like a large money making concern. Mm-hmm. And they're not going to pay you. Like, there's no way that you could justify those salaries unless you're just like close. This is how I think anyway. I mean, tell me if I'm wrong, but there's no way you can justify those kinds of comps unless you're just really sitting close to the source of the skim. And, you know, you're working on such large deals and such large volumes of money that a tiny, like what looks like pretty minimum overhead becomes like millions and millions of dollars. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's got to be like a very leveraged kind of like fee making type business where you can justify those kind of returns on.
Yeah. And I mean, like, I would say like the classic example of that is like a PE fund, you know, 2 and 20. Right.
Yeah.
And so I would go even further to say it's not just like you sit closer to proximity. It's like you are either the rainmaker or you're on the rainmaker's team.
Yeah.
Right. And so, yeah, I think most jobs coming out of a business school are not, you know, I mean, let's say 20 years ago, PE was the thing to do. PE was like the opportunity to go into, and
that's,
I mean,
where like the big the Josh Harris's of the world were coming out of the PE. The new like sports league owners were like coming out of PE.
Yep. And so it's like, you know, that was a heyday. You made your money then, and now it's like super saturated. And it's like, unless, you know, you have like some sort of guaranteed route to the top, or you have, you know, like someone, you know, within the firm who's highly favored is like taking you under their wing and like bringing you up. There's no guarantee of that, right? And so it really comes down to like a trade-off of like, okay, do you want to try and grind that path and hope that you're one of the lucky ones, or do you want to like go out on your own and like try and start something? Like a lot of MBA grads now, not just Harvard, you could extend this like Stanford, Wharton, I'd probably say maybe a broader subset of the M7. Like, hey, they'll go try their hand at entrepreneurship, or actually even more niche, which would be like a search fund.
Oh, a what?
Which is like a mini private equity.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah. Yeah. I'm so curious though. Cause just like, maybe I just never had that kind, because like HBS must be like a place like full of really ambitious people. Like what's the mindset of like the people there? Is it like, do they have the ambition where they want to be on, you know, they want to be seen as like, they want to achieve like Sam Altman levels of notoriety, or do they just want to like figure out a way to make, you know, top 1% type income for the rest of their careers and live in a really nice neighborhood with a good school district? Or do they just want to like anonymously ride the coattails of some company, strike it rich and retire early? Or is it sort of all, you know, There's people in each of those buckets.
Yeah,
what are people thinking?
Buckets.
You know?
Yeah, sorry to cut you off there.
No worries. Yeah,
Yeah, there's people in each of those buckets. I think it definitely skews more towards like the Sam Altman. Actually, it skews more towards like want to have like a top 1% income, nice home and a nice, neighborhood, on the social register, probably locally in that respect, and like have all the bells and whistles that come with it, that lifestyle, right? I'd say that's like probably where like the shape of the bell curve is,
Yeah.
the bulk of the folks at HPS. And then you have your outliers who are like, yeah, like I want to be like that guy or that girl, or yeah, I'm down to chill and just like coast at a pretty cool company, right? So
Where are you on that?
I used to be closer to the I want notoriety and like very outsized outcome.
Right,
And
right,
now
right.
it's just like I mean, I'm not on that trajectory anymore, I would say. Like
Yeah.
I'm kind of just like I'm chilling,
What
you know.
changed?
What changed?
Yeah. How did you get from one track to the other in terms of your thinking? I asked this because you had, and this is one of the reasons I reached out to you was just because you had this one tweet where you said that you feel like it's necessary now to sort of redefine the metrics of what is considered success, which can mean a lot of things to a lot of different people. It meant it. I kind of, I mean, I could see myself saying that. I don't think for this necessarily the same exact reasons as you saying it or whatever, but it resonated, and I was curious what you actually meant by that.
Yeah, happy to elaborate. So for me, where that was coming from was a sense of like, so it's so I'll start broader and then narrow down to me. In the broader context, it's kind of like you see a lot of Americans just in general, like they're not hitting the traditional milestones. Like they're like the older generations, they're not getting married at a younger ages or waiting to have kids. They're not even they're not on track to purchasing homes and stuff like that. So they're not hitting all the traditional markers of adulthood. And it's like for me, who's also, like, I mean, I'm very highly educated. I have 3 degrees, but I'm not on track for any of that stuff right now, And I mean, it's fine, no one's looking down on me or no one's saying otherwise. So it's just kind of like there's that general sense. Now, more specific to me, it's just kind of like I went through things prior to business school. That when I was coming in, like coming into business school, as much as it was like 2 years of working really hard and being engaged socially, academically, professionally, I was still carving out time for myself to think, like, okay, what do I really want? Right? Because there's not really another like milestone to reach after this. And so it was just more so of like, I didn't feel that there was much guidance from broader society in terms of like, okay, what should I be working towards now? And even more so, I think that those traditional milestones don't really work in today's economy, in today with today's material conditions for the average or modal American. So I'm just more open to redefining it for myself, which I'm happy to give a more concrete framing of that. But yeah, that was just more or less the genesis and the motivation behind the tweet.
Yeah, I mean, I relate to that just because even at my, I'm 47, I'm like 20 years into my post law school career. And if I count just going after college, I'm like 20. I lost, I don't really count going to like law school as like time off. Like that's a harder grind than working, right? Like, so if I count that, that's 25 years, a quarter century of grind, like post college. And you're right. I mean, even for me, coming from a different generation, like Gen X, I think we are already had a sort of like, it was starting to become less coherent as to like what the plan was. And you were sort of just like taking in ever-changing market signals as to what you were supposed to do. So, like, for me, at the time I came out in 05, you know, like, everyone was like, oh, yeah, it was a ton of people like me. Like, you know, came out of college, worked 2 years, realized that you weren't really making enough money to do what you wanted to do. And then you're like, okay, well, then I hear this thing where people go to law school, they come out and they work for a big firm and they're making I don't know what it was at the time, $165,000 a year. And that sounds good. That sounds better than what you're making. You're making like $65,000 or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then you say, okay, and then you do that. So people came out, they worked for the law firm. But then by the time it was like 05, it was like, wait, all these people are going west to Silicon Valley and they're joining startups and they're you know, in a flash, you know, with like one ring of the bell on at the stock exchange or whatever, they're millionaires.
Mm.
You know, so then I saw a lot of people try to do whatever they could to parlay their like legal chops into a job, maybe in-house at a tech firm or something like that, or maybe try and work for, maybe try to transition over to a VC. And there's a lot of people who are doing that. And then I saw, you know what else I saw was a lot of lawyers who suddenly wanted to, they were doing what I do, like they're working in the finance industry and then they're working like securities or something, regulatory stuff, boring. And then, you know, Bitcoin came along, the whole crypto like wave came, and I saw all these lawyers I knew, like really smart ones too, suddenly like recast themselves as like crypto experts. You know, and they were like going around, you know, and they were like at a firm and they were like, oh, yeah, I'm in a crypto practice, going around, you know, giving they're giving tutorials on how the crypto industry works and stuff. And I'm like, really? You never did this before. So is it, my point being like it just feels like people get. The only indicator, it truly is a market. Like the only indicator as to like where you should be heading is like where the action is, where the comp is. And that sounds really normal. Like, I mean, like as I say it, it sounds almost obvious. But the thing that's missing is any semblance of like, wait, what do I really want to do? Like what matters to me? What kind of work would I like to do? Nobody gives a shit about that at the end of the day. And I learned that very quickly. And at first I was like, that's tragic. Like, you know, how do I resist that? How do I figure out, you know, mm-hmm. And then later you're like, you know what? Fuck it. I mean, why fight it? That's just how it works. And maybe the name of the game is to just make enough money until one day I don't have to do this anymore. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Not exactly like the most inspiring way to describe 25 years of grind, but frankly, that's how it really was. I mean, you know, there was very little room, in my opinion, to really sit down and say, like, okay, what really motivates me or interests me? Like, what would I like to do? I mean, that to me is so absent that they create that. Like, you'll see a lot of career guidance and you'll see a lot of advertising and PR about that idea that you should do what you love, but no one actually does it. I mean, that's why they say it. It's because, like, no one actually does it.
You know? Yeah, I mean, it's definitely, like, more closer to a fantasy than, like, reality for most folks, right?
Yeah.
And I've been fortunate enough to come across people who do what they love, and they just happen – and it just so happens that what they love to do, they're also compensated very well. And these are, like, some of the most amazing human beings to be around. Like, their energy is infectious, and you're just like, wow. If like, you know,
what are they doing?
You know, at least in my space, like tech and VC, I see it most common, like, you know, whether you're a software engineer and you just love the code, or you're an investor and you just love talking with founders and backing the best and brightest of them. Like, they're just super passionate about it, right? And there's a lot of money behind both of those activities. Now, obviously, one has like way higher upside than the other, but at the end of the day, after a certain threshold, like, you know, if you do it really well, and you're at the right firm, you get compensated pretty well regardless. So, yeah.
Can I be on? Okay. my read of that now, from where I sit now,
mm-hmm.
is that that's not really what I mean, or I think even like the, you know, even the sort of like PR version of it means. I think a lot of those people genuinely enjoy it because they're careerists and they enjoy working. They like they're like locked in, I guess is the term. Like they're like, you know, they excel at and the thing that they're truly passionate about is like hitting targets, being like they're very conscientious people, being just really good at what they do. That's a little different, I think, than having the freedom to sit back and say, like, wait, like, what, you know, absent this careerist arc of mine, which is to, like, you know, jump into a business, rise within that business by doing the best I can and really engaging in, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. That's great. People should do that. But I think that that's different than saying, okay, forget the careerist aspect of this. What do I actually like doing? What do I actually want to do? And that kind of idealism, I think, is almost useless. Like, there's no point in even thinking about that. And yet, there is a lot of, I think, at least PR-originated confusion around the two. Does that make sense?
No,
I might be saying this in a very confused way, but
no, it's a hard concept to like kind of neatly unpack. So I appreciate you trying to do it. I understand you. I totally get what you're saying. It's like, and just to kind of recap, it's essentially like this: the ideal narrative of like, if you just follow your heart, follow your interests, you know, like you'll find something and you'll never work a day in your life like that, right? That's the PR version of it.
That is that you nailed it on the head. That's exactly the PR version. Yeah. That's the saying, right? If you love what you do for a living, you'll never work a day in your life. Yeah. That's exactly it.
Right. Right. And so, you know, and it's like when that comes into contact with reality, right? When the rubber meets the road, it's like way different. It's like that Venn diagram of people who actually fit, you know, into that intersection is very, very small. Right. And I would say, like, you know, to kind of respond to what you're saying, the people who I met who, like, have the best of both worlds, like, they're very career-driven. There's no doubt about that, right? I think for me, I look beyond just kind of, like, the career accolades and the ladder that they get to climb, and I just look at it more of, like, this is how they see the world. They see the world through their craft, right? They're craftsmen, they're craftswomen. Of whatever it is that they do. And I think it's like, I think in that sense, it's very beautiful. Is that accessible to everyone? Absolutely not. Is that even something that you can still routinely market as like, this can happen to the average person? Absolutely not. You know, the material conditions, the economy doesn't really support that for a lot of folks. You know, I will say this in the most explicit form. You know, a lot of these people I've met, they've also come from like very good families. Right. And so like they also have like the permission, you know, both explicit and implicit to pursue what they love. Right. And it also happens to be something that compensates them well. So there's that. I don't want to leave with the message of like, you know, on this particular topic of like, don't pursue what you're truly passionate about, because I actually did that. And that was a huge reason why I got into HBS and have had the journey that I've had. I wouldn't trade my 20s and really the journey I took, you know, I wouldn't trade it for the world.
Was that the aerospace?
That was part aerospace and part writing. So this is something I don't really talk about much anymore, but I used to also write for Forbes for 5 years covering early stage startups. So that's really how I got my whole in into like the whole tech ecosystem and whatnot. And so I got to speak with a lot of folks, you know, general partners at VC firms, you know, CEO of like, you know, massive early and late stage companies. You know, I got to talk to a lot of these folks that I had no business talking to. Okay. you know, just by virtue of my background, you know, studying aerospace at MIT. And so for me, it was just kind of like, wow, this is like really cool. And, you know, I just followed my passion of writing that I developed while I was an undergrad there at the Institute. And it led me, you know, it played a huge role in the positions I got, the access I had, and, you know, ultimately getting into HBS. So I'm very cautious not to tell people, like, just don't pursue your interest, because you never know where it's going to take you. But at the same time, I don't say outright, like, you should totally do that, because it's like, there's no guarantee it's going to even work out.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah. And it's just like, I would say your generation, you had way more room to fail. And so I would actually argue live like really interesting, like early adulthood lives compared to my generation and compared to even Gen Z's. Like, I'd speak with some of these cracked is the word, you know, the kids like to use nowadays, you know, cracked Gen Z's. And it's like, they're very, very talented and extremely competent. I'd probably say even more competent than myself. Right. But when you actually ask them, like, well, what is it that you enjoy? What is it that you like to do? You're like, what just naturally interests you? They don't really have an answer for that. They kind of struggle, right? Because they've been so focused on getting the next accomplishment, the next achievement that makes their resume better, so they stand a better chance of getting into an elite undergrad, and then, you know, like, do the elite internship to get the elite full-time job, and they're running in the same circles. It's a whole thing. It is a whole thing, man. And so it's way more intense than it was when I was an undergrad. And it's just kind of like, I wonder, do these kids even enjoy their undergrad at a lot of these elite institutions? You know, they're more pre-professional schools than actual colleges in some sense.
Have you heard that? I don't know how true this is, but like, I've heard college is just a lot tamer than it used to be. There's like far less partying. There's far less drinking, there's far less hooking up, there's far less just general college style experimentation, let's call it. And there's a lot more studying. or maybe gaming or something, I don't know. But I've heard that, like, that there has been a real pullback in like the sort of like party culture that we used to have on campuses.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, Jesus.
Especially MIT. Dude, MIT was crazy. Oh, bless you. MIT was crazy, dude. I don't know. Was it crazy when you were there? When I had friends that went there, I would go visit them in the summer during school. Like in the frat scenes there and stuff. I had some friends at ATO. And MIT was insane. Was it the case? It was insane. It was a harder party school than almost any other school I'd ever visited.
Yeah. I mean, look, that's a lot. So it's like MIT is not known for that, but it definitely is. Like, so I was in a frat at MIT. And so, like, for me, it's, you have people from all over Boston, from Boston College to Harvard, coming to party at your frat on a Friday or Saturday, or if it's like marathon weekend, like the whole weekend, right? And, you know, it was just like, it's a great way to meet people. And, you know, my fellow classmates, it's just like, after a long week of grinding on problem sets, it's like, you got to let off steam. And so we knew how to party. We knew how to let off steam. It was a ton of fun. Wouldn't trade going to, you know, MIT for undergrad and grad school at all in the world. It was just a really fantastic time. So.
Yeah, no, but I'm just pointing out, like, I think that's great. I mean, actually, I'm just pointing out, I get the sense that now things have become more and more like professionalized, and I think that might be in part the fault of like my generation, where I suspect what happened was, like, a lot of people in my generation, actually their the whole like career arc that they were hoping for became a little bit disappointing on that front, on the sort of like passion front, and they were like, wait, I think I'm just working, right? This is just a job. Like, I'm literally just commuting to work now. And so what they did was they poured a lot of their excess sort of dreams and ambitions into their children. And this is what I'm seeing now. And I think it's going to manifest in the coming years as those children start to age into sort of college, which they are now, is that they're actually going to shoulder a lot of the sort of like unmet expectations that their parents sort of like almost subconsciously handed off to them, if you know what I mean. I don't know if that, if you understand what I'm saying, but
no, I get you. It's like essentially
when you get to know more parents. Yeah.
Yeah. Like these parents, you know, it's like, by the way, would you describe yourself as like Gen X? Is that fair?
I'm Gen. I'm like younger Gen. I was born in 1978. So, I graduated college like 2000.
Mm.
So I think I'm pretty solid, like younger Gen X. Yeah.
Younger Gen X. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I'm like at the cusp end of being a millennial.
Yeah.
Like I think it's 97 is when you're officially considered millennial, and I was 95. So, or I'm sorry, 97 is when you're considered Gen Z, and I was 95. So yeah, I think for me, I totally get what you're saying. It's basically, it's like, you know, the dream of follow your passion didn't really work out for, say, Gen X. You know, I think you guys had a lot of turbulence, you know, in the economy and whatnot, and you know, it's just like you guys kind of had to settle for what you had, right? And had to sober, like life made you sober up very quickly. You got hit with a dose of realism, right? And so it's like, okay, you know, well, if I can't do it, you know, or I got to make sure my kids are more prepared to navigate like this environment, and you err more on the side of being conservative, I would say it's to the point where it's like your kids are your project, and it's just like, you know, they're more a reflection of you than really being their own selves in some sense.
Yeah, for sure.
So yeah, I mean, I see this a lot even with my classmates, like, you know, well, sorry, I gotta choose my words carefully here. I see this a lot in the circles I run in.
Yeah.
It's not restricted to just my classmates from, you know, the schools I've attended.
I mean, it's not an insult, it's just an observation. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think
right.
How it is, yeah.
Right. No, but let me I want to point to something like very particular about this, okay. Which is like, you know, in the circles I run in, I can quickly tell whether someone has like a sense of self and is like, okay, are they here because they genuinely exercised agency in making the choices, or was it because like their parents told them to do that thing?
Right.
Right. And it's extremely obvious. Like, you know, it's just, it's like night and day, right? And a huge part of it for me is just I spent a lot of time around, like, you know, the Silicon Valley types, let's say, high agency people. But I mean, there's like, putting aside the kind of the kind of hollow marketing around that phrase, like, I met a lot of people who like they own the path that they took, and they very much have a sense of self. Like, they're very distinct individual, based on like the choices that they made, right? Their life is just, I would say, is definitely a reflection of your choices. And I highly admire these people, right? Now, the other camp, you know, some of the folks I run with, like, they are their parents, they're projects of their parents.
Yeah. What is the give? What is the tell?
I think the tell is, honestly, it's like, you know, even in like some social settings, it's like, you know, they're way more wanting to follow the crowd versus like voice an opinion, whether it's for or against something. Like, they just don't want to stand out, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it's not like, oh, you know, like, you have to stand out to be an individual. It's like, no, it's like, you know, you ask them an opinion about something, maybe, you know, something that's around a heated debate, and they'll give one opinion in private. And then they'll give another opinion in public just to make sure that they fit in, they don't stand out, right?
Right, right. Yeah, they're just trying to, I mean, it's not, yeah, I see what you're saying. Like, they'll try to ingratiate themselves into whatever situation they find themselves in, because I presume it's because they feel obligated to do it, because they're trained, right? So they just want to be sure that they're not saying the wrong thing, they're kind of on a mission.
Yeah. Yeah,
Yeah.
exactly. You put it well.
Yeah, I suppose. I don't know. Like, I don't know the I didn't know many people like that. I felt like everyone I knew was in my like was kind of just I think it was a little bit different for me because we were all latchkey kids, like my generation, and like parent, like back then, like dude, like people trusted schools. You know, like I know that's gone now. You know, like parents, you can't just put your kid in a school. You know, you've got to like really pay attention and guide them, and you've got to, you know, I've got like friends who are like spending, they virtually have like no free time. And any free time is, you know, driving their kids to this practice or that or, you know, whatever. And they've got college visits that they've got to go to. They've got, you know, it's like crazy the amount of intensive parenting that takes place. But in our era, like when we were our the kids' age, like dude, like parents just dropped us off at school and we're like, okay, you know, give me a quarterly report, and if it's good, we're all good. And you just do whatever the fuck you want. So I will say that about Gen X in our defense. I know we catch a lot of flack, but I think there were it was a generational thing that like we more or less chose like where we wanted to be. And but now I feel like if you were seeing that in some meaningful, you know, percentage of your peers, I think it's just going to get worse. I think like the coming classes are going to be more filled with that kind of personality, and I'm not sure that that spells anything good for like the future. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think the future is obviously it's just not going to be as dynamic. It's not going to be nearly as interesting as like what's come before, in my opinion, because you just have a lot of people who are just like you're just seeing a convergence in the mean, right? You know, a convergence to safety, a convergence to, you know, like what's the sure path. And on an individual basis, you can't blame any single person for making that decision. It's just that it has like a collective consequence, which is like things I don't think are just going to be that interesting anymore, you know? And I think you're just going to have like a very like stagnant status quo in that sense. I'm kind of just like maybe generalizing here, but I mean, I kind of already can feel this in like, you know, in society with like art and culture, you have a lot of remakes, you know, sequels and stuff, and there's just not really anything new. And I think it's a reflection of a culture that doesn't want to take risks because there's very little room for taking risk nowadays, you know, with student loan debt so high, and it's just like not that many jobs being available, whether you're, you know, an MBA at a top tier business school or you're just an average Joe trying to find the next thing. There's a lot less margin for error, right? And the unfortunate thing is that that margin for error is actually where you're going to grow the most as a person, right? I'll tell a really short story. I've shared this once before on social media, not on Twitter, so you'll have never heard of this, but one of my professors, one of my favorite professors from MIT. You know, we were having a conversation shortly before I graduated. And I remember him saying this, and it's always stuck with me throughout my 20s and really for the rest of my life. He's like, Fred, you know, I see a lot of your classmates are getting like just incredible salaries coming out of the school, right? But you guys are gonna feel trapped by that salary. Like you're gonna get used to it, and then you're not gonna wanna explore and take risk or just like just try out new things because you're gonna get very comfortable to the standard of living that that salary, you know, affords you. And he was absolutely right. Like I think I look at a lot of my classmates, you know, from undergrad, and it's like, you know, those are the people who've like hit all the traditional markers and whatnot, right? But I think there's something lost in that sense of like, okay, you know, like what happens if you had only half that or a quarter of that? Like, what things would you do that you otherwise wouldn't consider doing, right? And so it's a very it's a very nuanced take, and I remember posting it on my Facebook and getting a lot of pushback on it. Like
What were people pushing back on that for? Like,
they were just like,
how
no,
do you
a
push back
huge
on that?
part of it was like,
It seems self-evident to me.
huh?
It seems self-evident to me. Like, how could you, like, what would be the, what would be the response, like a pushback response to that?
Yeah, a pushback response is like, well, I need to do this for my family. Not a lot of us come from like privileged backgrounds. It's like, that's totally valid. Like, I'm not judging you based off of that. But like, it's, but there's trade-offs, right? And that's what my professor was just talking about. That, like, there's an inherent trade-off when you take a very lucrative job. You're just gonna have a way lower risk tolerance to try out new things, whether it's professional or personal. Because you just get very used to that salary and like the lifestyle that it comes with, right? And it's like, I'm seeing this now with myself and like, having the compensation that I have. It's like there's things that I would like to that I may have been way more interested in doing when I had less money. But now it's like, no, it's just like it just doesn't fit anymore, right? And so yeah, I think a lot of people there, that was like one standout example. This was like years ago, so it's like I can't really remember the gradient of comments here, but there was a range. I mean, I had a fair number of people agreeing with me. I think the thing is just kind of like people are just very sensitive about like, well, why do they do the things that they do, right? I think this is getting back to like do what you love, right? I think in some ways, like outside of the marketing, we try and there's maybe a self-delusional component to it.
Oh,
Like, oh,
cool.
I'm doing this for like the right reasons or noble reasons or like high-minded ideals, when it's really just like, no, I'm just doing this for the money, right? And I'd rather, I'd rather talk with someone who's like very aware of that. Like, why are they doing the thing that they do? And it's like, those people you can have a very refreshing conversation with because they're not trying to delude themselves.
Yeah, even if it's not necessary. I mean, I think because some of the things that you do here, some prof I mean, I do think professors are very helpful, can be very helpful that way, where they will just kind of give it to you straight. And I remember when I was a student aged, I had a lot of unanswered questions about, like, okay, what is this that we're getting ourselves into here? Like, everyone's like shipping off to these firms doing work on shit that I don't even really understand what they're doing, like, and why, but it earns a lot of money. And then I would get professors that would sort of contextualize like what this all means. I don't mean like what the nature of the deal was, but what the nature of the industry really was, and the nature of exactly what you just said, the way that earning that money changes you and sort of entraps you. And that I was known as the golden handcuffs, right? But it goes deeper than just golden handcuffs, I think. But like, I had a conversation with a friend the other day, or the other week, we were hanging out, old friend, and we were talking, because we're like later, like I'm already starting to think about like really dialing back my career and work and just sort of like taking a little bit more easy from here on out. But like, so we're at that age, and so we talk about, what would happen if like you had enough money that you didn't really, where you were work optional. And I had one friend who's been doing, just god awful fucking software consulting shit for the past 25 years. And he was like, I think I just keep doing what I'm doing. I was like, wait, you don't understand the hypothetical. Like, you're rich. Like, you don't need to work. You really don't need to work to keep up your desired lifestyle. He was like, yeah, well, what the fuck else am I gonna? I need something to do. I was like, you wouldn't do this. You wouldn't get up in the morning, stress out, drink three cups of coffee, and have to deal with like shitty, unreliable team members and stupid deadlines. You wouldn't deal with that, would you? And he was like, yeah, I think I would. And it offended me to an extent that he actually said that, because I was like, there's no fucking way that that's true. You would go on one fucking, first class, all expense, one top tier vacation to Hawaii, and you'd be like, fuck that, I'm not doing that again. You know what I mean? It's self-delusion. It totally is self-delusion. And I think that my view of, I'm not saying that this is all it is. I'm not saying that this is the necessarily the only right way to think about it, but the truth is, like, you know, we work because it pays. If it didn't pay, we would not work. We would do something. I'm not saying we wouldn't work. We wouldn't have a job. You know, we would do something else with it, right?
Right.
And so starting from there, I think I'm starting to be a little bit more like when I see, I guess what I'm trying to say is when I see people at the beginning of their career talking about what they hope for, what, you know, like what's like that's not wrong in terms of like seeing the potential of work to be a great thing and you can accomplish great things. But in terms of like with over time, what I see as the reversion to the mean, it becomes exceedingly clear, which is, I think the goal is to make enough money so you can stop working. And then you can sit back and be like, all right, this is what I really want to do, you know? But I don't think a lot of people want to hear that because like you said, their lifestyle has risen to the level of their income and they're not really, they're kind of paycheck to paychecking it to a degree.
Yeah.
And it feels, you know, if you're, I guess what I'm saying is if you're paycheck to paychecking it, if in that process, you're not accumulating a stack where you're like very clear about the timeline at which that stack is going to be big enough where you don't have to grind anymore, right? If you're not doing that, then you need a coping mechanism to keep you going. You need to recast your situation in some way where that's not the case, where it's not about that. And then you get these absurd conclusions like, yeah, I've had all the money in the world, I'd still be installing enterprise software for the government. You know what I mean? Like, come on. Really? I don't know. It's a little bit of a black-pilled view of careerism and work, but like I would say for me, as I got closer and closer to that point where I was like, okay, I'm not as fearful of like the money situation anymore, I could be a little bit more honest with myself about the true nature of work.
Mm-hmm.
So mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah,
that's where my head's at anyway.
No, it totally makes sense. I mean, it's just like, you know, I appreciate the black pill, right? Because, you know, it's like so, someone who's like, you know, fun fact, I've spent more time in academia, you know, since turning 18 than I have like being a full time working adult. So,
right.
You know, it's like even amongst millennials, I kind of have like a very, you know, it's like I just have a different experience of work. You know, I'm not as used to it as some of my peers who just like graduated undergrad and just like started working and they've continued to working. They're pretty far in their careers now, right? That said, I think there's a deeper issue what you're getting at, which is like, you know, the real lifestyle that we want or that a lot of people want, they hope that their work, their career would bring them, and it hasn't. You know, if anything, it's left them more trapped and more adrift from their actual goal. And it takes a lot of courage to say, if this is a case, that no, I actually don't enjoy doing this and I'd rather do something else. And it means, you know, at the cost of like the lifestyle, the very privileged lifestyle I live now, right? A lot of people probably feel that, but are not bold enough or courageous enough or just like have enough conviction to actually act, you know, act along those feelings, right? And so y'all, you know, it's just like it's so easy to fall into a life where you're just on this like track in some sense, and you know, before you know it, it's like you're of a certain age and you're just like, wow, where did all the time go? And then you start asking yourself the harder questions, like, did I actually enjoy the time that I've spent with this much of my life already consumed?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I think the danger is exactly that, is, you know, the lifestyle creep. I think the reason that happens is because the reality is that having to work blows. Everyone knows this. But you keep it going because why. I think in the very beginning, at the beginning of the race, it's like, because it's awesome, because this is humid, you know, this is how great things get done. You know, this is the great race. It's, you know, and as it grinds a little bit, you start going, you know, this is kind of a chore, right? Like, my boss is kind of a dick. This company kind of sucks. The pay's not, it's not as good as I hoped. My bonus is not as big as I thought. The you know, that starts to factor in. And then what happens is you get on a treat track, right? Like, that's when you start saying, okay, to keep myself going through this next stage of this, you know, multi-stage race, I got to get myself a reward cycle going on, a shorter term reward cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And in some way, like, maybe what it is, this is just me thinking out loud, is that makes sense. I mean, that's how people work. Like, we set ourselves up with goals and rewards so that we can get there. But the worse, like, the shorter that treat cycle gets, the more I think it becomes a problem where, you know, I think you see people start to develop like dependencies. You start seeing people start taking like higher risk behavior, drugs, things like that. It happens. You'll see it with time. And I suspect that some of it comes from trying to maintain that treat, the sort of like, someone called it the libidinal treadmill.
Yep.
And that's why I think, and I'm just talking about the both pathological versions of this, but the more like, I think the more common embodiment of this is really expensive vacations, home renovations that are not needed, $600 shoes, you know, like starting to become really expert at consumption because the consumption itself creates the drive, and then the drive creates more consumption, and it just becomes this sort of like, I'm a consumer and I'm a worker, and the worker in me necessitates the consumer, and the consumer in me necessitates the worker, and it goes round and round, and then pretty soon you're fucking miserable. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I totally get you. And I mean, like, that's basically, you know, it's the hedonic treadmill that you mentioned. And I think even more so, it's just kind of like, it's a lack of agency, kind of bringing this conversation full circle, right? The same lack of agency I see in people in my generation and younger is like also manifest in like, you know, the older years, where it's like, wow, it's part of it, it's like, you don't have as much time as you think you do. And the harder questions about life are really starting to hit, and there's nowhere to hide. You're either satisfied with your life as it is, or you're not.
Yeah.
And if you're not, are you willing to make the very difficult, meaningful, material changes to your life to bring yourself more into alignment of like what your inner self wants? And I think that, you know, and this is where it kind of goes back to my tweet, which is like, I think the traditional life path, not just material conditions, but it's also just, I think there's a misplaced faith in careerism that, you know, it's like, you know, it's sort of related to like, do what you love, you don't ever work a day in your life, but also the fact that like, you know, you're more than what you do, right? I mean, I love what I do. Yeah, I've loved the jobs that I've had before, or at least most of them, not all of them, to be frank, but most of them, yeah, you know. And it's like, I felt, and I was never afraid of working long hours because I just loved what I was doing, right? But there's still, you know, one thing I've come to learn about myself is that, you know, like, I've really neglected my hobbies over the years because I was so focused on achievement. I was so focused on getting that next milestone. And, you know, like, for me now, having spent the majority of my adult life in school, like, climbing one hierarchy, status hierarchy, or, you know, like, you know, achievement treadmill, you know, it's more so of like, well, now that my life is open-ended, I don't plan to go back to school at all. You know, it's like, what milestone should I hit? Should I even have milestones, right? And so I do think that there's this absence of wisdom in our culture about like, how do you actually craft a meaningful life, you know, that is beyond what you do. You know, there's a famous VC, Ed Andreessen, who says, you know, who's written a book along the lines of you are what you do. And I've come to now categorically disagree with that. I don't think you are what you do. I think you are what you do because you need to make a living, right? Similar to what you're saying. But there's so much more to our lives and what it could be, but the work week as it is, and I think, you know, you work in, you know, you went to law school, I went to business school, so we're naturally attached to like higher compensation professions. Those types of jobs don't leave you with a lot of time to discover who you are and like to really get to know yourself and develop yourself outside of your ability to generate an income.
This is the end of part one of a two-part podcast. Part two will be on the Patreon feed. If you want access to bonus pods, go to patreon.com/planamag to hear the second part of this podcast with Fred.